So last week, the San Francisco Mime Troupe was in Mendocino County Wednesday at Point Arena Theater and Thursday in Todd Grove Park in Ukiah. This is about the 18th year the troupe has been bringing their political satire musical comedy performances to our county. And our guest today is Michael Sullivan, longtime actor, director, and writer with the San Francisco Mime Troupe. Welcome, Michael. Thanks for being here with us.
Hi.
So I'm going to take a little bit longer than I normally take to read your credentials. I've known you for years in your capacity with the Mime Troupe, but when I went to your website, which is michaelgenesullivan.com, I was really blown away by how much more you are involved with and the extent of your career in theater. So, Michael Sullivan is an actor, writer, director, blogger, and teacher committed to developing theater of social and economic justice, of political self-determination, and, of course, musical comedy. He's a regular contributor to the Huffington Post. He's lectured or taught acting at Yale University, Stanford, the National Theater Conservatory, Trinity College, Dartmouth College, University of Southern California, University of California Humboldt, New College of San Francisco and Santa Rosa, and the University of Minnesota. He has been involved with the San Francisco Mime Troupe, and also the American Conservatory Theater, Berkeley Repertory Theater, California Shakespeare Theater, Denver Center Theater Company, San Francisco Theater Works, the Magic Theater, the Marin Theater Company, Symmetry Theater, Central Works, Word for Word, the Lorraine Hasbury Theater, African American Shakespeare Company, and the San Francisco Shakespeare Festival. Off-Broadway, he has appeared at the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, the Asian People's Theater Festival in Hong Kong, the Festival of People's Theater in Canada, the Kwashan International Outdoor Theater Festival in Korea, the Israel Theater Festival, and the International Festival of Theater Action in Belgium. His one-man show, Did Anyone Ever Tell You, You Look Like Huey P. Newton?, premiered in the New York Fringe Festival and went on to award-winning and critically acclaimed runs at the Vancouver Fringe Festival and at the Eureka Theater in San Francisco. A San Francisco Mime Troupe resident playwright since 2000, his adaptation of George Orwell's 1984, which played late last year in Queens, opened a decade ago, directed by Tim Robbins with the Actors Gang, who then toured the show around the country and the world. The adaptation has since been published in the U.S., Canada, and Spain, with productions on, with performances and productions on five continents. The Russian translation is scheduled to be in Kiev. Michael's awards include the San Francisco Chronicle Award for Outstanding Achievement in Acting, the Bay Guardians Upstage Downstage Award, and San Francisco Bay Area Dramatic Critic Circle Solo Performance Award, and nomination for Did Anyone Ever Tell You, the Dean Goodman Choice Award for Principal Performer, and the Israel Barron Award for Recipe. Michael was awarded the Sacramento Area Regional Theater Award for Best Direction for I Am a Man at the Harbor Theater and restaging of San Francisco Mime Troupe's I Ain't Your Uncle, won several Dramalog Awards, including Outstanding Direction. In 2015, Michael was given Stanford University's Equity Award for using his work to help achieve racial, gender, and age balance on stage, And in 2016, he was honored by the Bay Area, by the Theater Bay Area as one of 40 stellar theater artists, supporters, and champions that have changed the face of Bay Area theater. So Michael's wife, Valina Brown, is also a renowned actor and with the San Francisco Mime Troupe. And according to Robert Kelly, artistic director of Theater Works, where they both have appeared, they are royalty in the world of Bay Area theater. Michael's ability to play across all different races and cultures is quite spectacular. So that is, I am super impressed all over again, and I've already just been one of your main fans for years and years. So,
thank you.
Yeah. So, Michael, how did you come from an artistic family? How did your theater art skills develop?
Well, my mother was a visual artist. She was a painter and sculptor, not professionally, but she, you know, she'd gone to art school, and you know, that was pretty much it. Acting really wasn't a thing that I was particularly focused on. I wanted to be a history teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like most of the books I have all of these history books. I love history. I did write a play when I was a kid, which, oddly enough, they asked a class I was in to write. We were supposed to get together and write a play, and all the other playwrights, we were supposed to write it together. They all kind of fell by the wayside, and I ended up writing a play about school funding. I was, like, in the third grade.
Uh-huh.
And the inadequacy of school funding, and it ended up with this big protest march by a bunch of students on City Hall. So that was, like, my first political play. But I still wasn't interested in acting. I got into acting, actually, in high school because Valina, who I've known since middle school, we were in high school together, and she was in a little theater company, and I wanted to spend more time with her.
Mm-hmm.
So I auditioned for the theater company just to be around her. We weren't dating yet, but we were friends, and I liked her. I had a crush on her. So I ended up in that theater company, and that was really how I started really getting acting. She'd been acting for a few years at that point.
Mm-hmm. So how and when did you become involved with the San Francisco Mime Troupe?
Well, when I around that same time, my father took me to a mime troupe show. You know, uh-huh. He knew I was interested in history, and my parents were very political. And, I should tell you, here's a weird story. The reason I ended up in San Francisco, because I was a little kid in Los Angeles, and I ended up in San Francisco kind of all of a sudden, spur of the moment, when I was a little kid, my whole family moved, and I'm never sure why until many years later. My mother worked for Bobby Kennedy.
Uh-huh.
And was there when he was assassinated.
Wow.
And after the assassination, she suddenly left town, and my sisters and I didn't know what was going on, and she went back to her family in Detroit, and then she came back to Los Angeles, and within like 2 weeks, we moved to San Francisco. And it wasn't until later I found out that we moved to San Francisco because the FBI had kind of moved us to San Francisco because they didn't want my mother and the other potential witnesses to the assassination killed, as happened to a lot of people after JFK's assassination. You know,
yeah.
We were kind of in witness protection. I didn't know this as a little kid. I found this out much later from my father. Anyway, I had political parents.
I'll say you do. Yeah.
Yeah. And so my father took me to see a mime troupe show when I was in high school. And seeing that, I was like, you know, I'd already started to act a little with this theater company in high school. But I went, this is what I want to do. This is exactly it. It's political, it's fun, it's big, it's musical, and it's got all this history in it. This is precisely what I would like to do. And so, as I started doing more acting in college, working for different theater companies, I always had my eye on the mime troupe as my goal. It's like, wherever else I'm working, I'm trying to figure out how to work at the mime troupe. And at that point, the company really didn't cast people from outside very often.
Uh-huh.
But I got to a point where I'd done enough stuff where they kind of knew who I was, and I'd auditioned for them a couple of times, and then finally they cast me as a replacement actor for a tour. And then I was lucky enough, the next year, they were doing a show called Seeing Double, which I auditioned for and got in only because somebody else who had been with the company turned the part down. And I got into that show, and they did the show for 2 years.
And
so I ended up being in the building a lot.
When year? What year was that?
That was 89.
So, go ahead. No, that's fine.
No, I was just going to say, so then after that, after touring, and that show went, you know, overseas, and we toured around the country, and we played it off-Broadway, and after that, they got used to me. And I was like, it's weird now, because I started, at that point, I was the young guy. You know, somebody who, when I did my first show at the troupe, Arthur Holden was with the company. He had joined the company when I was one. And so now I'm in the other end of that, where there are people who, you know, who are working on the show who are simply not born when I was when I started with the company.
Yeah, I know you have some just great young, energetic folks, strong too. So let's talk a bit about the San Francisco Mime Troupe. How and when did it get started, and why mime?
Why mime? The eternal question.
The eternal.
Well, the troupe was started in 59-ish.
Wow.
By R.G. Davis. Yes, next year is our 60th anniversary. He started it as a class, as a workshop, just to do traditional silent mime, commedia, body work, in that kind of period in San Francisco when people were doing happenings and creating new theater and messing with the styles and trying to figure out what you're going to do and how you're going to tell these particular stories. And so Mr. Davis had, you know, studied silent mime in France, and he'd studied commedia, and he'd studied all of these different physical styles. And so he started to teach it, and the troupe, at that point, the R.G. Davis mime troupe, started to do performances, but this is also at the time of, you know, the civil rights movement is, you know, kind of coming to fruition. The anti-war movement is just starting up. The Cold War is at its height, and so there's a lot of political oppression going on in the United States, and things you're not supposed to talk about, things you're not supposed to question. And as Davis and the company started to question those things, it seems like they kind of went, you know, we can only go so far silently. It's hard to really get to the nitty-gritty of the issue when you're standing there in tights acting like you're trapped in a glass box or something.
Mm-hmm.
So they started finding older pieces, pieces from the Renaissance, commedia plays that had to do with class, which they normally do. And they started adapting them or doing shows about war from the, you know, the 1700s and 1800s, different things that allowed them to deal more precisely with what was going on. But they still weren't necessarily creating their own plays. The company's name changed, San Francisco Mime Troupe, but they also found a definition of mime. The actual definition of mime isn't silent. It's the exaggeration of everyday life in story and song. It comes from the word mimic. And, you know, some people don't put those two words together, you know?
No,
you,
I never have.
And being a mimic, you're vocal. It's an exaggeration. Basically, there's a type of theater in ancient Greece where these words come from. Where you are doing an exaggerated style of something to get the point across, and also to mock the powerful without actually naming your character after that person. You might want to make fun of Pericles, but you don't want to actually say your character is named Pericles because he might have you thrown off a cliff or something. So if he's got a particular, if he's got a limp, if he's got a lisp or whatever, you just give that to the character. And you do it in an exaggerated and big style. And you do, the, you know, when you're talking about the issues, you're pointing up the hypocrisies in a big way, in an obvious way, so that the audience can get all of the points. And so that version of mimic is where the mime, the name mime comes from. And at that time, the troupe was well-known enough in the Bay Area that they didn't want to change the name. They were like, well, where's the San Francisco Mime Troupe? What else would we be? And then they became very connected with the rock movement and the Haight-Ashbury, so Jefferson Airplane and Quicksilver Messenger Service and the Grateful Dead, all of whom did benefits for the mime troupe. The Grateful Dead's very first performance as the Grateful Dead, because they were the Warlocks before that, was at a benefit for the San Francisco Mime Troupe.
Wow, that's a piece of history, huh?
Yeah, and Bill Graham was the San Francisco Mime Troupe's business manager.
Huh.
And so what he did, he realized in putting together these different events for the Mime Troupe fundraising, was that there was more money in rock and roll than there was in theater.
Probably still is, huh?
Yeah, right. And so he slowly switched, but he was always very supportive of the company for the rest of his life. He'd always, you know, he'd always give us money and would do what he could to help us. And the Bill Graham Foundation still does that, which is wonderful of them. But the company, as time went on, again, just kept getting more and more famous, and still had the word mime. And so we had to always tell people, it's not silent mime, it's not silent mime. It's this weird thing, we're like this weird open secret, you know? And for years, really, every year we were just like, when are we going to change the name? And just at a point where we decided what we would try to do is we would be the San Francisco Mime Troupe, like in California. But if we left California, we would be SFMT Presents. And then it would be about the show. The focus would be on the title of the show, just like it is on every show. You know, if Hamilton goes on tour, people don't focus on the production company, they focus on Hamilton. But unfortunately, just at that point, the touring circuit dried up, and it made it's incredibly hard for us to get outside of California now. There's no money to bring us. It costs a lot to do the show every week. But, so we're still the Mime Troupe.
Yeah.
And we, like I said, we've got our 60th anniversary. When we had our 40th anniversary, we considered using that as the chime to change the name. But we couldn't come up with a good name. We asked our audience. We said, well, does anybody have a suggestion? We're having a contest. And almost all of their suggestions involved the word mime. It was the talking mimes, the not mimes, the loud mimes. And it's like, no, the mime part is what we're trying to get rid of. And so we're just stuck with the name, and we will be until the sun goes out, I guess.
That'll be a while, I guess. So it never ceases to amaze me when the mime troupe hit town. There are typically about a dozen folks who arrive from the Bay Area in carpools and in a large size moving truck.
Yeah.
With a stage and lights and sound equipment and the band musical equipment, costumes and props, and a souvenir store. So you get to Todd Grove Park in Ukiah about 1 o'clock in the afternoon and start unloading that strategically packed production, because everything goes just so to fit in the truck. They build the stage, often with moving parts, set up scaffolding for the lights and the sound, and prepare the store. This is several hours of hard, heavy work with every member of the crew participating. And since they come in mid-July, it's often 100-plus degree temperatures that these coastal folks are working in. They take a little break for dinner and then start getting into costume and headspace for the show. The live music starts at 6:30 and the show at 7. Lisa's is one in Todd Grove Park. I know you perform lots of places. And the show never fails to be high energy, cutting edge, timely, and just these totally unique performances. Often the actors play more than one part, and the musical numbers are just fabulous, these extravaganza. After the show, these actors circulate in the audience collecting the money, collecting donations from the crowd, because the show itself is free. Then they change and start breaking down, repacking the truck in that precise manner that fits just so, and finish sometime 11, 12 o'clock midnight. Ukiah folks house them, the raging grannies feed them, and they drive north to their next show where they do this all over again. So what is the work ethic with the troopers, Michael? How do you organize yourself, and what roles do you have?
Well, everyone has something that they're interested in and good at. And as the, you know, and there are different members also. Like, you know, the company, most theater companies have an artistic director or a, you know, an executive director person in charge. And the Mime Troupe doesn't. We have a collective of actors, writers, directors, designers who act as artistic director. So when you see a Mime Troupe show, some of us are in the collective. Not everyone is in the collective. Some people are only there for that summer. Some people are, you know, interns or workshoppers who've come from around the world to study with us for the summer. So everyone, or like our stage manager who's not in the collective, she's, this is her first year with us, and I don't know if, you know. So everyone in the collective has something that is their thing to do for each summer. They kind of each take on a job. Like Lisa Hori Garcia has been doing our store, you know, and setting that up and making sure that's right and really in charge of that. That used to be the job I did. And then Lisa picked it up. Keiko Shimasato Carrero does the costumes and makes sure that the she doesn't design. She didn't design costumes this year, but frequently she does.
Mm-hmm.
But she has to take care of them and make sure they're in good order. The guy who does sound, Taylor Gonzalez, he's a collective member, and that's his job, setting up sound, running sound, making sure everything's good with that. Our keyboardist, Daniel Savio, yes, a relation.
Yeah, he's his son, isn't he?
Yes, he's his son, yes. He's in charge of the pit, making sure the musicians have everything that they need and making sure the sound is set up for that. This year, I'm in charge of packing the truck. How everything goes in the truck and how everything comes out of the truck. And also, since I've been around the longest, I kind of direct how things get set up, you know, bringing the decks out and stuff like that. So we do have to, and we get a little practice before the year starts, or before the summer starts, of doing previews and just kind of like, hey, everybody's got to get into this. And I think one of the things with the Mime Troupe that does make it different and makes people who work at the troupe more likely to pitch in and to do all of these other things. I mean, we are a union company. We're an equity, actors' equity company.
Mm-hmm.
Not all of the actors are in actors' equity. But despite the fact that some of the actors you see are in the union and some aren't in the union, and the musicians are, you know, jobbed in, and some of them are permanent and some of them are not, everybody who's on payroll is paid the same amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
And that commitment that the troupe has always had, I mean, one of the reasons that we have four actors instead of five or six is the extra money that we have to spend because we are committed to paying everybody the same amount.
Mm-hmm.
Which most people don't even think about. You know, there are other shows that I've been in where I've been surprised. I'm like, oh my goodness, the equity actors are getting like $200 a week more than the non-equity actors. That's not fair.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't. I don't even think about it normally because at the Mime Troupe, everybody's just paid the same amount.
Mm-hmm.
We don't like publicize that. We don't tell people that much, not because we're embarrassed. We just don't think about it. We go, this is the way it's supposed to be. But like I said, because of that, because we try to have everybody have a voice and because we pay the same, people who work for the company are more likely to be willing to pitch in, to give volunteer time, to do all of this other stuff because they understand that we're trying to not just portray a version of an economic and social justice version of the world, but also try to exist in it.
Walk your talk.
Yeah.
So what about dispute resolution? Certainly, there must come disputes, either personality conflicts or differences of opinion. How do you resolve those?
Well, normally we talk things out. We do have a human resources department, which is basically Volina, because her degree is in counseling.
Uh-huh.
She has a master's in counseling. And so normally that's the case. But, I mean, with personality, I've been in this company long enough to have been here with people who simply just did not like each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the way it is. And everyone just kind of goes, well, they don't like each other. It doesn't mean that they put that ahead of the work.
Uh-huh.
You know, the job isn't to, you know, disagree all the time. The job is, but what's going on stage? This is always about the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, however we might argue, and I mean, I'd been in the collective at points where people were, you know, at the edge or slightly beyond the edge of getting into fist fights during meetings.
Mm-hmm.
That was a while ago.
I've been to some of those meetings, too. some meetings like that.
Yeah, but then, you know, when they're on stage, if those people are supposed to be friends or lovers, they are.
Mm-hmm.
Because knowing that, it's ultimately, it's about what's the message for the audience? What do we want the audience to take away from this?
Yeah, that's great. So it is 127. You're listening to KZYX and Z, Corporations and Democracy. Our guest today is Michael Sullivan, a writer and actor and so much more than I ever knew you were, Michael. I'm just amazed at your credentials. We will go ahead and open the listener lines now. If you'd like to call in and talk with Michael, 895-2448. So why do you believe theater is an effective medium for political activity and education?
Well, I think that theater, for me in many ways, is one of the last real opportunities for the working class to talk to itself. You know, film takes such a huge budget, and it goes through so many distortions. And, you know, ultimately it's passing through the hands of the very wealthy and the producers to decide, you know, mm-hmm. are they going to be, you know, a terrible person? Are they going to, in this one moment, maybe critique capitalism a little bit, trying to find an opportunity to have revolutionary dialogue. You can have a lot of films that are about sexism and racism and transphobia and homophobia and all of these, but when it comes to capitalism, it's very much a third rail.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're having to, as a filmmaker, go to capitalists to get money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the same with television, and the same with print media, that ultimately what goes on the page is going to be up to a capitalist. You're not going to see CNN say bad things about the concept of capitalism very often. So it makes it difficult. Whereas theater, because with theater all you need is a performer and an audience. Everything else is extra. A stage, a script, you know, lighting, costumes, a bigger audience, all of those things add to the reach and to the production values and all of that. But ultimately, all you need is a performer and an audience. So it gives the political performer a filterless relationship with the audience. There have been shows that I've done at other theater companies that have been questioned by artistic directors. Like, I'm just an actor in the show, but the artistic director will bring up, say, we don't want to piss off the bankers on our board of directors.
Mm.
So can we downplay this scene? If we do this, then, well, there's that one guy on the board who's an works for the insurance company, and we don't want to piss him off because he gives us, you know, $200,000 a year, so we don't want to say anything bad about insurance, say, or health care. After the 2008 crash,
uh-huh.
You would think that there would have been this flood of movies and television shows and plays critiquing what happened, but there weren't.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, there's a couple, like, you know, was it the big, what was it?
Yeah, I saw something recently, but I don't remember.
I mean, there's been a couple, but it also takes a long time, especially for theater, which is very frustrating. The mime troupe can be very nimble. It's like some years we will literally say, we don't even want to talk about what the show's going to be yet because it's an election year and mm-hmm. we can't write anything until we know who won,
mm-hmm.
you know, or there's something going on in the international spectrum that we want to hold off. We don't want to commit to an idea and have to change it at the last minute. So we can be very nimble, but most theater companies applying for grants nowadays have to give a 2-year throw. You have to say what you're going to do in 2 years. So in an event like the 2008 crash happened, those theater companies were already committed to do plays they'd committed to 2 years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So they can't just turn around and go, oh my goodness, let's do this.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, it's very difficult and rare. Some of them did. Some theater companies did say, we're going to cancel this one show and we're going to do it. Can't happen here or something like that. Or do my 1984. That's happened a few times where companies just said they would just cancel one of the shows they were going to do and say, we're going to do 1984 instead because of the 2016 election.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, great.
Mm-hmm.
But it's difficult. But theater is it's a business that can't be offshored.
Mm-hmm.
It has a direct human interaction in a way that films and nothing else can. And so it is a chance for us to be able to stand up and talk to actual live human beings and have them see the political issues of the play and have their response. And, very importantly, know they're not alone. Because you're sitting at home and you're reading a book or you're watching a movie, and that might be really political. You know, you're reading Hard Times and you're going, yeah, that's what's happening now, but you're alone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If you go to see a film, you're not alone, but it's not a human-to-human relationship.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to see a play, you are in a community of people who, however different they are, age-wise, gender-wise, gender identification, all nation of origin, religion, despite all of that, those differences, the commonality that you all chose to come to see this play is part of an endorsement of that community, and you get to have an actual reaction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you laugh, mm-hmm. you cheer, you decide, you know,
boo or hiss,
how is this analysis going? You talk to people.
Uh-huh.
So that encouragement of the community and endorsement of the community is also a big part of it.
And what kind of responses do you get after a show or in the course of the show?
I would say after every Mime Troupe show that I've been in, all low these many years, there are always people who say, this is the best show ever. Because
you get better every year.
It happens all but one. one year we didn't get that. But they're different people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that show that's about teachers, the teachers come up and go, oh, thank goodness, this is the most important thing, and education is so important. You know, or it's a show about veterans, or it's a show about, industrial workers, or it's a show about tech workers, that what people feel. And those people, they may have come, like I said, all of these years, but that show expresses.
Really resonates with them.
Yeah, and so that, how important that is. So it's so that's generally the expression after show is best show ever. Right? Thank you.
Uh-huh. What about persecution? I know living in the Bay Area, it's a liberal bastion. You travel around a lot. Have you ever gotten a hard time or anything scary from your performances?
Oh, we've had death threats and things like that.
Oh, well, you know? Just as long as it's stuff
I mean,
like that.
You know, I was doing a long time ago, I was doing a radio show like this, and somebody called in and they were making threats, and I was like, okay, I can't really do anything about that. I can't crawl through the phone and talk to you, or hopefully you'll listen to the rest of this, or maybe you'll see the show and realize we're not attacking you. We're actually on your side, because it's not like to some working class guy.
Right, yes, and that is... So your show this last one with Joe Hill, the time travel back to 1912, where there was the Wilson had just been elected and the Socialist Party was gaining strength, and there was so much optimism among liberals and then a few years later, when it goes back, it's a different story. It's always been mm-hmm. The tug of war and the going back and forth. I know.
But you were asking about So in terms of response and in terms of
negative
persecution,
response.
I mean, we were on a no-fly list briefly, which really surprised us. It wasn't a national no-fly list, but sometime after a 9/11, and they were putting subversive groups on. For some reason, the Seattle airport put the Mime Troupe on their no-fly list.
Mm-hmm.
And we hadn't been to Seattle. And normally, if we're going to Seattle, we drive anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really kind of weird.
Mm-hmm.
We found out about that. The main thing that happens, I would say, in terms of the bigger things that happen to the troupe, is that every time the reactionaries are trying to defund the National Endowment for the Arts, which happens every few years, the mime troupe has been a stick with which they beat the NEA. They will say, how dare you fund this group? Last year, the Breitbart News attacked the mime troupe and said, you know, because the principal character in the show was an undocumented immigrant and a lesbian. And so they were talking about how we were pushing this undocumented immigrant lesbian agenda, which, hey, I didn't even know there was one. I didn't know they had meetings. So that ended up being kind of a big deal. And they were saying, anyway, this is what your tax dollars are going towards. And we just used their attack on us, like, in our publicity.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, Breitbart News says this is what we are. Hey, they're right. But we've had, you know, different senators and members of House of Representatives just talk about the mime troupe on the floor of the Senate or of the House and just say, this company is talking about communism and socialism and anarchy, and our tax dollars are going towards making sure that they get this message out. And this is wrong. And we've been fortunate that the NEA, for the most part, has always stepped up and said, yes, this is exactly the sort of thing we should be funding. These are free shows, educational history, and it's an alternate view, and isn't this the sort of thing we should be doing? Now, this past year, we didn't get money from the NEA for a bunch of reasons. Hopefully we'll get it in the future. Who knows? We'll see. But that has been, I would say, the biggest bar. I mean, the other bar to us has just been that we used to be able to tour all over the country because we would get a lot of money from the NEA and because universities and community activist groups had enough money to be able to pay us to come out and do the show. Because we are like, this is our job. We have individuals have money and families and rent and, you know, we're not doing this for free.
Right. You're not all trust fund babies, huh?
Yeah, right. Yes. And that's the big thing, not trust fund babies. And so much theater has become about that. But as those organizations in the kind of undeclared depression that the United States has been in for decades now, all of their money has dried up. So those little, you know, Rust Belt cities that we used to play.
Oh, that really need your message.
Right, that they haven't had, just don't have the money. 2 years ago, we did a show about police brutality and racism, and we were going to take that show on tour, and we were going to play it in Minneapolis and Milwaukee and Detroit and Cleveland, Chicago, Philadelphia, and then finally in Maryland. And each one of those places had to drop out of the tour because they couldn't raise the money.
Mm.
They would go to the universities. They didn't have money. They go to community organizations. They didn't have money. Each one of them fell out except for Maryland. And so we drove all the way across the country to do two performances in Maryland.
Wow.
At a small college. Just because we were like, we've got to go. We have not been out of the state in so long. Before that, our previous time was we went out to do two performances in Ohio, like 3 or 4 years before that. So the rest of the country, we here in the Bay Area are like, how much is it? I mean, if we go on tour, it's like $30,000 a week. And a lot of people go, $30,000 a week? Heck, that's not that much. You know, in San Francisco, that's rent, you know. But it gives you an idea of how different. We go other places, and $30,000 is like, that's what their house costs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so there is and has been for some time, like I said, this general downslope depression that's happened in the rest of the country that we in San Francisco and Los Angeles and New York don't see.
So as money moves to the top 1% and funding for things that benefit people decrease, how are you managing your finances? Clearly, you've cut back on your scope, your range of performances. Mm-hmm. I know there was a grant that you usually get. Would that be the national grant that you didn't get this year?
Yeah, the National Endowment Grant, which has been up and down. I mean, some years we would get more, some years we would get less. Before I was with the company, the mime troupe was getting $75,000 a year from the NEA, which doesn't sound like a whole lot.
It's a couple weeks worth.
Yeah, but this was in the 80s.
Uh-huh.
So back in the 80s, That's like three times that amount. And they got it for 4 years straight, and that made a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
And we definitely, you know, so the NEA money has gone up and down. And since we don't take money from corporations, that's the thing, is a lot of theaters.
What about nonprofits or socially B corporations, socially responsible corporations? Is there any give, any
leeway? It's so hard to find one.
Mm-hmm.
We looked around at one point. We were really like, this is getting ridiculous. We need to find another income stream. And so we looked around and we tried to find what would be considered a responsible corporation. And it was incredibly difficult.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that are like, we put all this money to environmentalism. And it's like, yeah, but you're using all of these rare earth metals, which are awful for the environment, and you're using plastics, because we're near Silicon Valley. So those are the corporations that were coming at us.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got underpaid workers putting together your phones or computers or whatever. It's very, very difficult, because our standard is kind of high. So we tried at one point, because there are a large number of, strangely enough, worker-owned corporations in the United States. You just don't hear about them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have a couple here.
Some of them, but they didn't necessarily have that much money either.
Right.
So what we ended up doing is turning towards doing something we hadn't done before, which is a yearly fundraiser. So every March for the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, we've done a fundraising event, which raises us a certain amount of money. But we also have been really pushing the idea of sustaining comrades and allies.
Mm-hmm.
They, like, as I mentioned after the show, and I tell people, it's like, we might play to 45 or 50,000 people in the summer. Out of that entire group, if 1,000 of them said they were going to give us $200 a year, just over the course of the year, if they committed to $200 over the course of the year, even if they didn't put money in the hat at the show, that would fund most of the summer show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because the budget for the summer show is just over $200,000.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be it. And then the other money that we would get, we could put towards adding more actors and our educational program, which is three educational programs. Then that would be a big part of us being able to bring students in who can't afford, not trust fund babies,
mm-hmm.
to study how to create political art, and people from overseas. And then we have a program, we go into the schools and we teach activist playwriting to high school students. And then we have a program where we bring high school students into the mime troupe to help them collectively create work on issues that they think are important. All of those things are things that we could put that money towards if we had the summer show set.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Right.
So if you've got 1,000 friends who've got $200 they can spare over the course of the year, they can go to our website and go on as an ally or a comrade or whatever. Sign up, do that, and that would be the game changer for the mime troupe if we could really have that level of sustaining support.
Well, that seems doable. I know there's five organizations, KZYX being one, that I give $10 a month to. I'm retired on a fixed income, but I can I put aside $50 a month for charitable giving, and so even people that don't have money can give a little bit, and this work is so valuable. We were talking a little bit before the show about your anthology of plays. Let me just take a minute here to say it is 1:45 and you're listening to Corporations and Democracy. Our guest today is Michael Sullivan with the San Francisco Mime Troupe. I'm your host, Linda McClure, and if you'd like to call in, the listener line is 895-2448.
The anthology.
Yes.
Yes. Well, one of the things that's happened over the years, because we do topical plays and we're dealing with these issues, and then as soon as that show's over, we have to start thinking about the next show. I mean, we're already thinking about what we're going to do next year.
But not soon enough that you can't respond to something major that comes up.
And it's collective right now. Do we want to commit to doing an older show that has to do with international politics, or to write a new show that'll have to do with the new face of whatever happens because of the midterm elections?
Mm-hmm.
Those are the kind of debates we get to have on our days off. But One of the things that I've been working on since I became the resident playwright, I'm not the only resident playwright, but I've been the primary resident playwright for some time, is that it's important for students, first of all, that are studying theater in colleges and universities and even in high schools around the country and around the world, to know that there's a different way to deal with issues. So often, the plays that they're dealing with are super psychological dramas, or psychological comedies, even family dramas, all of these things that are dealing at a very personal level, and very seldom are they dealing, having a step back, kind of looking at a play as almost a new Brechtian comedy. They don't get taught that because there are no examples. And one of the reasons are very few examples. Like Dario Fo writes this style, or wrote in this style, that to make sure that the teachers and small theater companies or whoever have this other way of looking at things, have these other examples, whether they're going to produce those shows or just study them. And the mime troupe, because of our topicality, we have tendency to not focus on getting the scripts out. If we can't tour around the country, and if we can't be on television, or can't be in these, you know, we've done what we can on the internet, and even that's very difficult. At least to be able to get the scripts out, so people can go, oh, this is how the mime troupe dealt with war profiteering. Something that would go, oh, how did they make war profiteering funny and still bitingly harsh?
Mm-hmm.
How do you write a play that isn't just going to make people kill themselves when you're dealing with police brutality and institutionalized racism and the war on drugs?
Mm-hmm.
How does this get dealt with? And so years ago, I was like, oh, I'll just go in and I will digitize all the mime troupe scripts from like 1959 on. And I'm a really slow typist. and it was really hard. And every time I was doing it, then I had to stop and write a new mime troupe show, or a show for, because I write for other companies too.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to, finally, I just went, you know what? I'm just going to do the last ones, the ones since I've been the resident playwright, because I already have those scripts. I don't have to retype them.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to reformat them. It took over a year. To pull the scripts together, get them reformatted, to write on all of the stage directions, to find the right photographs for certain moments, to get endorsements from people, introductions, to gather all of that information together, and then format the whole thing into one big ebook.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then make sure and say, we're going to release this for free.
I know when you said that, I thought, well, yeah, I mean, that is absolutely in line with your philosophy, with the organization's philosophy, and it is tremendously generous and giving, which is part of the philosophy.
Right. I mean, we want to make sure, like I said, that if we hold on to these things, jealously guard them or put them out of the price of our average audience member, because there are audience members who want, they just want to, you know, thinking back, what was going on in 2012 or what was going on in 2003 that they felt super strongly about, and it's like, and they loved that mime troupe show, but they've seen all of them and they want to differentiate them. They want to be able to go back and relive that moment. It's like, here, you can just download it. Right now, I worked on it. The program I used was a program that created it as an iBook for inside of Apple's Creative Suite. So it's in the iTunes store. And right now what I'm doing, and I have time off, is to create like the Android version,
mm-hmm.
which is so much, since I've already done all the work on the other one, I only need really like 2 or 3 days to finish the Android version. And then both of them will just be, you can click on go to the Mime Troupe website. I mean, you can go to it right now, and you can click on the iBooks version and just download it to your Apple phone or whatever.
And
then there's a PDF, which is huge. That's the one I wanted to place.
Right. So does that mean we have several theater groups in our county. Could any of them do one of the plays, or is there another process to do that?
There is the other process. It depends on which show it is, like how recent. But The deal that I made with the collective about this was basically, if somebody wants to do one of the shows, we're going to set a base, like, okay, if you want to study it, you want to do scenes from it, you want to read it, you want to download it, all of that's free. If you want to do a performance of it, then it's going to cost. You know, mm-hmm, then it, mm-hmm. But it's not much. Like, I think I said it's like $300.
Uh-huh.
And because there's another process that has to happen, a more difficult process for the mime troupe, which is getting the music.
Uh-huh. Oh, right.
The music, the lyrics for all the songs are in the script. The actual music isn't, because a lot of our music isn't written. You know, we write out the original music, but then it gets changed in rehearsal.
Uh-huh.
And things get changed, and all of those changes don't get necessarily notated.
Uh-huh.
So if somebody wants to do one of the shows, we need to get, basically, to get paid. They say, okay, we're going to do it in a year or something like that, like theater companies do. We'll put it in the next season. We need time to have somebody go back and notate the music as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. And so, that's a huge task, it seems like.
Yes, yeah. It is a huge and a ridiculous task. I mean, what we would probably end up doing is giving as much notation as we can, and then finding some way that the... Because our shows are so musical. It's not
right,
just the songs.
Yes. And they're
it's
not just music.
Music in between.
Right, and the little sound effects for whatever's going on stage at the time. Your musicians are extremely talented and versatile. Yeah. All of you are versatile. Yeah,
it's being a musician for the mime troupe, it sometimes takes people a couple of years to figure out what that means, because it's much more like playing for the circus.
Uh-huh.
You know, every take, every time somebody turns their head, they hit their head. An idea hits them, and there's a ding, you know. And it's different for different shows.
Uh-huh.
Some shows are much more melodramatic.
Right,
And some
yeah.
shows are more commedia, and some shows are just clown shows. So each show having a different thing, and the musicians have to have all of these styles in their repertoire. So,
and I know you're one of the writers for the mm-hmm. for the show, and so the shows that I've watched, they often leave me laughing and crying at the same time. They educate mm-hmm. me. Where do you get your inspiration? How do you do that?
Well, it really depends. Like this year, I did not write the show at all. I'm only an actor, which is a big... I haven't done that for like 12 years.
Uh-huh.
And so... But generally, we our process starts with, well, what's the burning issue? What's the thing that we feel like must be said? And, you know, whoever's writing for that year, this year it's Rotimi Agba Biaka, you know, to find that thing that he felt like, this is what I really want to talk about this year. And so we have meetings, and people do research and read, you know, articles and books to talk about what these issues are. Sometimes it's just the writer reporting to the collective repeatedly. Sometimes the whole collective's involved much more. It really depends on what's going on in people's lives. But a big part of what we have to do is predict the future, to be able to read the news. You know, I read the news constantly. In addition to reading all my history books,
mm-hmm.
I'll read news articles, and then I'll find a time in history that resonates with that. And so I'll read about what happened at that point, and then I check, you know, the social media, and then I'm reading foreign press, going through all of that to figure out how to tell this particular story in a different way, in a more worker-oriented way, whatever that issue is.
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of that, have to generally, like, not all the shows are farces. You know, this show isn't particularly farcical.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the shows are, you know, just laugh riots, and some of them are more not.
But they're always political.
Yes, but they're always political.
Yeah.
So it's a huge amount of research that starts with what do we feel we have to talk about.
And coming from a class worker perspective.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always going to be, well, these are the issues. What is this like for the workers? What's really going on here? And like I said before, originally, the idea of the working class talking to itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Fascinating. So what, we're coming on to the end of the show. What are your plans? You said you have time off, and last time I saw you, you were headed up to Mateel Center in Southern Humboldt. You're back. You have a little time off. What else are you planning to do in the next few months or year?
Well, I'm this show, when this show ends, I go into another play at California Shakespeare Theater. This excellent show called Black Odyssey, which is basically a retelling of the Odyssey, only with an Iraq War veteran.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, really good. And then I'm supposed to go back to New York to have a reading of one of my other shows, one of my non-mime troupe shows, called Fugitive Slave Act, which is based on a true story that took place in the 1850s. And then there's another play I'm working on that has to do with how oppressed people see how the majority culture, the dominant culture, the colonializing culture, how it identifies and defines an oppressed people, and how those people take that in, and how do they to survive in a way psychologically? How do you accept the racism? How do you enact the racism? Who do you become? And how much of that is you, and how much of that is the way you've been defined by your oppressor? And to do all of that, I'm using Genghis Khan.
Uh-huh. That's natural, huh?
Yeah, unnatural. So I'm working on that script now. And then I might, I've been teaching at ACT, which has been interesting, teaching playwriting at American Conservatory Theater. I just finished, and I might go back in the fall. Which I'm sure is weird for them, because I'm teaching political playwriting.
Well, I am so appreciative of you taking time today to talk with us, and I so appreciate, along with our whole community, our whole county really appreciates your stop on the coast and in Ukiah, and we look forward to it so much every year.
Oh, that's wonderful to hear. And we look forward to it, too, despite the horrible heat and the twisty, drivey mountain roads.
Right.
I think I told you this year I was driving the truck and the brakes went out on a twisty, windy road.
Oh.
That was scary.
I'll say.
But despite all of that, we love coming up there. It's such a wonderful, supportive audience. And, we like coming up and kind of doing our part to be part of the movement with you guys.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye, Michael.
Bye-bye.